You're very welcome back to the second hour of the 9 till noon show. Thank you so much for all of you texting in. The caller says Brian sounds wealthy. Another, Greg, aren't we ignoring the burning issue for many parents? Exclusive school toilets for their transgender. How many underlying this concern decides the vote in Donegal? What is a toilet for transgender children? I'm not being smart here. I genuinely don't know. And what schools specifically have toilets that are allocated for transgender children or teens? And what is the, in case I'm missing it and I don't want to misrepresent your views, what needs to change there? So text me back, tell me the school, how it works, and what are your actual concerns? Is it being accommodated at all, or what is it, please? And let's discuss what that caller describes as the burning issue. Remember the areas 100% redress candidates were elected in. Many people are afraid to speak out about it, and many are still burying their heads about it. But will the secrecy of the ballot box allow them to speak out? Disabilities are not getting a look in because all the talk is of defective blocks. It's time the 100% redress realise there are more issues of than one concern. The one thing I'll say about that, if you don't mind, is that there are many people with disabilities in defective concrete blocks as well. These aren't separate issues. One doesn't negate the other. I'm very surprised that Charlie McConnell Oak is polling so well in his local area of Inishowen. This is not how we feel on the ground. We feel that he's not spoken out for us defective block homeowners, and we're on our knees. I'm in no way a Sinn Féin supporter, but I feel that Piers Doherty is the only one who spoke out for us. Charlie McConnell Oak cares more about farmers and what he can do for them than defective block homeowners, is one opinion there. All these polls mean nothing. It's a popularity vote, says a listener. I wasn't polled, nor was anyone I know. And there are people on that poll that are only 2% that will get my number one and number two vote and number three. All the other candidates who I don't want to vote for won't be getting my vote. So their names will be left blank on the voting card. Now, the problem there is just to understand the situation is that you're one person, right? So your opinion poll is an opinion poll of one. Whereas the opinion poll that was published yesterday evening is an opinion poll of 534, which is a sample size which gives a plus or minus 4% degree of accuracy. A caller says, did you not see what happened in the USA polls? Indeed, did you not see what happened in the referendum polls? You don't have to go over to the United States to see that polls don't matter. The only thing I'll say in relation to this is that this is an election. It's sort of like a first-past-the-post poll. It asks, 535 odd people, which is a decent representation of the population, what they're going to do. There's less nuances as there are in the United States, and it's very hard to poll in. It's very hard to poll in the United States. But he accurately did poll 50%, 50%, really. That's what the polls did show, that it was neck and neck, and it was when the dust has settled, it's kind of neck and neck there. There was one lady, one person who did the Ohio poll, and she got it completely wrong and has actually retired from polling now as a result. The last election, the TG Cahir poll overestimated Joe McHugh's vote and underestimated Padraig McLaughlin's. I'm not sure what areas they polled, but there's no way Charlie McConnell Oak's polling at 12%, which is higher than what he got last time out. I would say he's closer to 8 or 9%. Padraig is polling higher than 11%. Either way, it looks like Fine Gael are losing their seat. Sinn Féin are taking two. Fianna Fáil definitely one and maybe two. Pringle could lose out. Pringle's in a good situation unless he's been overrepresented. Another caller says, I agree, RTE News always starts with what's happening in Ukraine and Russia, when I think they should be talking about what's going on in our own country. Back to the election, though. Defective concrete is not just an initial issue. Letterkenny area has several housing estates impacted, many thousands of people, of course. And we've been covering defective concrete on the show for many, many years, as you would know, right from the very, very beginning. The only thing is, isn't it's not, we can't either pretend a situation isn't what it is. Of course, there are areas of Donegal whereby it's going to be a motivating factor to vote, but one has to also accept that in some areas it's not going to be of Donegal, it's not going to be the principal area of concern. And some areas really quite close to Inishowen as well. Re-election, it's very obvious that RTE are highly paid puppets representing the government financed by ourselves, the taxpayer. And the reason they're evidently down on Sinn Féin is that they and the government representatives are in the tax bracket that would be affected if Sinn Féin were in government. I don't know, but if a government personally signs off on a €750 million package, Is that going to influence how you cover things? I don't know. I don't know the answer, but 750 million euro is quite a sweetener. RTE have been utterly biased against Sinn Féin for years. Every time Israel murdered children in Gaza, RTE talked about hostages. In their coverage of Ukraine, they never mentioned NATO's plans to station nuclear missiles on Russia's border or the fact that Zelensky was never elected as Ukraine's president. He was appointed by NATO, is what they're concluding there. That opinion poll by TG Cahir had several questions, not just who was getting you number one. It also asked questions like who you would like to see as the next Taoiseach and several more. Will they reveal the results of these questions? I presume so. But listen, they've spent a lot of money. It costs a lot of money to do these polls, or a lot of effort. And they've got a good chunk of information, and they're probably going to leak it out, to stagger its what they reveal, perhaps. A 4.3% margin of error is huge. That's about 3,500 votes. If Donegal people vote two Fianna Fáil politicians back in, then they can kiss goodbye to any form of 100% redress for their homes. Empty promises from Fine Gael to include community buildings. It won't happen for about 3.5 years, just before it's election time again. Now, you see, I get where you're coming from, but every poll is a margin of error. And sometimes I think we can evoke the margin of error if we don't like the outcome of the poll. But normally it's plus or minus. You know, it's not necessarily plus four for one and minus three for another, though that has happened in the past. Greg, when Charlie McConnell has refused to interact with Highland Radio's top programme, I feel he shouldn't be afforded the opportunity to speak during the debates. I don't. In relation to that, the invitation has always been an open one for Charlie McConnell. We contact him regularly to come on and speak on the issues. I wouldn't use this show or the position I have here at Highland Radio in any way like that, to be honest with you. Individuals are entitled to make their views known. People listening to this show will be able to make up their own minds from all of that as well. But I'm certainly not a bitter person, and I'm certainly not someone that would hold a grudge, and I'm certainly not someone that would abuse the situation. I honestly can't believe why people could possibly still vote for Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, etc. They've had decades to change, but they've just made everything worse, and now more false promises that won't be fulfilled. They've ruined our country, believes the listener. Another, never trust the media's polls. Haven't you learned from anything? The anti-Trump bias in the US election. The US polls, the US is very different to here. The polls could be as far out as Fanad Lighthouse. I get you, don't get me wrong, and I'm not here backing polls because I haven't a ton of faith in polls. But this is a simpler type of poll that's less likely to be skewed, though not immune from that. If RTE said it was raining, I would go outside and check. After 600 million plus, they're the government's mouthpiece, 750 million. After 600 plus, they are the government's mouthpiece at the cost of the taxpayer again. I'm not a shinner, but RTE should never have been funded by our money. Not worth the licence fee. There is media outlets who don't spout BS. Frankly, Greg, in the conversation of RTE, that broadcaster doesn't recognise Letterkenny, the biggest town in Donegal. Their broadband Wi-Fi is also getting blurred with pickles. Also, Simon Harris ignored Letterkenny and never shows St. Patrick's Day Parade. This should be investigated. Okay, there's a lot in there. Maybe some autocorrect, but I think the main points of that was gotten across. On another issue, Gardaí have released images of over 100 people in the riots. What about the guy who stabbed three children and their teacher? Where is the justice? Well, he's arrested, charged and in prison awaiting trial for that horrendous stabbing of those children and their teacher. So he's locked up. Oh, do you remember Bridie and Nocala, who was on with us? The streetlights had been out for 9 months or something along those lines. There was no light in the area of Nocala at all. We spoke to her last week, and the lights are back on, which is good news, isn't it? So the lights are back on, all good news. So it does pay. It pays to talk, don't they say? Right, okay, keep your calls, comments coming in. Now, Gertrude Houghton is Gambling Support Counsellor with the Finn Valley FRC. Good morning to you, Gertrude. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for allowing me to come on this morning.
No, it's an important issue, and we cover regularly on this show, given its importance. We are in the midst of Safer Gambling Week 2024. Talk to me about the campaign and what's the aim of it, I suppose.
Okay, Greg. I suppose it's an annual event. I suppose becoming more now in Ireland. It's in the UK and Northern Ireland longer, but now this is there to just, I suppose, stimulate safe conversations around safer gambling and make people aware that there are supports there for people. That, again, hopefully people who are gambling, it'll help them maybe highlight, you know, am I gambling too much? You know, what am I doing? You know, am I spending more than I should? And then, you know, is there things out there that I could be doing to stop this, or also maybe to cut down on it? You know, the tools that are available out there to help them gamble more safely all year round.
It's so tough because it's almost like trying to empty a lake with a cup, because you're competing with so much else. You're competing with advertisements. You're competing with sponsored content. You're competing with... I'll tell you a little story, if you'll just indulge me, actually, Gertrude, at the moment. This is in terms of when people start gambling. I've often mentioned on this show that we're sort of conditioned very early on, you know, in terms of, say, for instance, if you're playing a game like FIFA, which many of our young people are, or Fortnite, lots of other games where you open something, okay, and there's a reveal and there's a gambling element to it. It kind of conditions the brain, and it always concerned me how early it started, and I always questioned those motives. It can't be a coincidence. I downloaded a game on the tablet for Hudson to play. It's for 2 to 5 year olds. It's an educational one. And what do you think forms a major part of the game? A fruit machine. Can you believe that? A fruit machine.
Oh my goodness.
So you load up the fruit into the holes and you pull the one arm and they rotate and they fall down and you either win or lose. And I was like, this is for 2 to 5 year olds. Maybe someone designed it and didn't realise the implications of it, but you're already sort of planting that seed of chance, of disappointment, of exhilaration, you know, when the right things fall. But anyway, this is all of this is what we're against. That's the point I'm trying to make, Gertrude.
Yeah. And I suppose that's what parents are facing now all the time as well. And then that's, you know, there's other people out there. Like, Greg, we all, to a certain degree, will gamble, you know, do now and again, maybe do 5 euros, 6 euros on the lotto or a scratch card for birthdays,
Grand
things
National
like that there.
Or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And maybe once a year people only do that as well, some things and that. So, like, we're not trying to stop, you know, or to say things about that. It's when it comes then, when it's affecting, you know, family life, it's affecting your own life. It's when you start to tell lies. And then those lies, you know, increase then. And before you know it, you're doing things that you never thought you would. Like, I'm privileged, you know, that clients put their trust in me and come before me and tell me stories of things that have happened to them. You know, sad stories. And we want just to highlight that there is a huge issue out there. Don't be in isolation. Don't, you know, stay on your own thinking it only affects you. There's supports out there. Come and talk about it. Mm-hmm. Get further advice and support. And then the other side is maybe a family member who knows that somebody in their family has an issue with gambling, doesn't know what to do about it. You also can make contact. Come and get support and find out what you can do. Mm. You know, maybe for some of them, they might be allowing this to continue, you know, and the things that they can do.
It creeps up on you very easily. I remember when I was in my late teens, early 20s, I worked over in England for a few years and I worked in pubs and what have you, and fruit machines were in there. And I'm not sure, I don't know if I was addicted to them, but my word, they took up an awful lot of my brain space. And I found myself very quickly at the point whereby you would easily drop a tenner in and then you'd win 5 quid. And there was this thing, really, you'd walk around and say, how did you get on? Because everyone would see that you were at it. And you could see everyone looking because their money was in the machine, right? And they kind of felt they had ownership of it. How did you get on? You'd say, yeah, you know, it's crazy. And then they'd say, how did you get on? I'd say, well, I won a fiver, right? But you'd never say, you'd never mention the 10 that you put in to get the fiver out, if you were lucky to get the five out. And I had to make a conscious decision not to use them, because I found that I wasn't getting paid very much, and I found that I would put in my last bit of money in them. As I say, I don't think I had an addiction, but I certainly had the beginnings of it. But I also had those early signs of masking, you know, on a very low scale. And I'm just thinking of the fellow or the woman that dumps all their money into online bingo or into a casino, and they go home, where's the money? You know what I mean? That's you can see how quickly it starts having impacts on people's lives, Gertrude.
Yeah. And Greg, for a lot of people, you know, maybe neighbours, friends wouldn't even know where they've been, you know, if they did, say, go to a casino or that, but they can do it online. They don't even have to leave their home. But, you know, that's shame for them then. So that a lot of the time they don't tell. Mm-hmm. And then they get themselves into further problems and further debt. And then their family, you know, that you know, maybe there's where bills aren't being paid, mortgages aren't being paid. You know, children are affected, not being able to go to the events or activities that they should be able to go to and things because the money's not there. And yet this might be a family that's with two people working and, you know, you're wondering, how could they not have money? But, you know, sadly, you know, there could be somebody there that's spending a lot of money gambling. And, you know, these are people that, okay, they say that it can be hereditary. And I know that I would have, you know, stories from people who grew up going to places, arcades with their parents, and then they continue to follow on that.
Yeah. And I think if you have any tendency for compulsive behaviour, or even any mild anxiety whereby you can have sort of circulating thinking and that kind of stuff, I think you'd be more, and I think that was probably my issue, Gertrude, I think that you'd be more disposed to a gambling addiction. I'm not a gambling expert, but I just, and there's a lot of us. So that makes you realise and understand how 130,000 people are experiencing problem gambling in Ireland because of the level of concealment. Is that a significant underreporting? We just simply don't know. But I know for a lot of people listening, Gertrude, they often would put this ahead of alcohol abuse and drug abuse. Not that there's necessarily a hierarchy, because it's never talked about, and lives are being devastated. And what can follow on from that? Yeah. I don't know, domestic abuse. Who is to say where it goes from there? But families destroyed.
Yeah. Exactly, Greg. And like you mentioned there about, you know, at a young age going into the slot machines and their kids and that. And like that's where there's a family in Northern Ireland who very much they are part of the GAM family. And they go around talking because they lost their son. And they feel as a result of gambling. You know, what happened was he was at school, waiting on between school buses, and he spent his time going to the machines. And then, you know, he went to university and whatever, and it never stopped. And sadly, he took his own life. So they failed as a result of the debt and, you know, the helplessness that he got into, that's why he got done that. And there's loads of stories like that, Greg.
There is.
And hopefully, you know, we don't want families to come to that. So that's why we're saying, you know, reach out, talk about it. You know, look for support.
And there are ways to gamble responsibly. This is not about saying, you know, gambling is terrible, never, ever do it. It's about safer gambling. So there are tools available to help people gamble more safely all year round. The one thing that I would always remind people, yes, you can do it for fun, but the bookies always win. And if you start winning, they switch your account off. That's so you're never going to get rich in a bookies, because as soon as you start winning, your account can randomly get shut down. But there's also lots of resources and sources and helplines available. So just run through the supports that are there, the event that's taking place, and tell us more about how people can engage with this this week.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying because it is Safer Gambling Week, we wanted to do something to highlight it. So today down in Cara House there in Letterkenny, we are having a coffee morning from 11 to 12:30. And we just, if people want to call in, they'll get a free cup of tea or coffee, which is nothing unusual in Cara House. But this time you might get a scone with it or a wee treat. And I will be there and I'll have some leaflets and that. Just letting people know that there's support out there. Now, I'm one of over 23 nationally family resource centres that provide gambling therapy and support service for families. So we're scattered all around Ireland, based on family resource centres. And there's also a helpline there that people can access, which is manned by Dunluce. And all these, like, there's also services where people now can go for residential care specifically for gambling. There's beds available for that. And that's all as a result of gamblingcare.ie, whatever. They have got, put the funds into that there now. And they've taken that money from bookies and that. But now with our new gambling regulation, there's going to be a tighter hold on things, and I suppose when ads can be put on TV, even around when people can gamble and things, hopefully yeah. there'll be more blocks than that.
Yeah, but they'll switch their resources. They'll switch their resources elsewhere. Let's not forget when they tried to restrict how drink was advertised. Next thing you know, 0.0 exploded all over the place, and these thinly veiled drink responsibly ads. Which are actually promoting drinking, popped up all over the place. So, you know, I can understand the legislators, what they're trying to do, but I also understand there's so much money here it can be gotten around. It's never too early, I don't think, or never too late to speak about gambling. There's a free confidential national helpline service. It's available 365, 9am to 11pm for individuals affected by their own or family member problem gambling issues. 1-800-936-725. And they establish... And we pump millions and millions and millions into horses and greyhounds in this country, astonishingly, but anyway, we do. But if there's a gap, if there's a gap in the day where there's not a live race somewhere in the world, they actually contrive to get one somewhere, even if it's in an empty stadium somewhere, just to make sure that there's something that someone can gamble on. That's literally where we're at. All right, then. Gertrude, thanks for your time. Yeah. Keep up the great work. Thank you very much.
Said, you know, my details are online, Greg. And if anybody, you know, wants to pop in today to Carra House or they want to, you know, phone me, my number, my details are there. And even just for a chat over the phone.
Yeah.
But just don't suffer in silence. Okay. Thanks very much,
Gertrude,
Greg.
Well done to Gertrude Houghton there, Gambling Support Counsellor, Finn Valley FRC. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. At the weekend, Letterkenny Chamber held its awards ceremony and Julian Ball of R. McCullough Jewellers in Letterkenny collected this year's Hall of Fame award. And we're joined in studio by he. Good morning to you and congratulations. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you. It's good to have you with us. And your son Gareth is with us as well. Hi, Gareth.
I've been roped along as well.
So. Yes, indeed. We'll see how much we'll need you. I'm only joking. Look, in the first instance, big congratulations, Julian. How did this go down with you? I suppose it's lovely to be recognised by your peers, but we're all different. Some of us, say, bring on the attention, and for others, we sort of more prefer to work quietly in the background. Which camp do you fall into?
I would definitely be... I'm a one-to-one, so I'd... for the deal with one person chatting to them in the shop. Whenever you're up on stage and everybody looking at you, it's not my particular field of it, but it's a great award, great honour, and I'm very, very impressed. I'm very, very happy to get it.
We'll talk more about you, but let's talk more about the business because, you know, McCullough's have been in Letterkenny for a very long time. So talk to us about the history of the business coming into the town.
1869, Robert McCullough came to the town. He came from Enniskillen.
We think Enniskillen.
The history is a little bit sketchy at that point back then. But he would be a master jeweller, which means he would have trained three other jewellers to get the master status. Came to town, set up the business then. He had an only daughter called Jean McCullough, who would be my grandmother. And my grandfather married her and then carried the business on.
In the early stages of the business, do we know how it was set up? Because we've got this, you know, this vision of a modern jewellers as yours is, and there are a few around. But I wonder, going back so long there, I wonder how it was presented or how much was on show. Was it made to measure?
I know in my dad's day as well, my dad was Bertie Ball or Robert Ball. And there would be people come in to him and say, Mr. Ball, I want a good watch.
Mm.
And he would go and get one, what he thought was a good watch for the person to suit their lifestyle and all that. Nowadays it's changed because people have a lot more information on the actual product itself. A lot of times they're coming in looking for something which may or may not be suitable for them. So that's where we're, as a company, we recommend what we feel is suitable for the person, a quality that we like. We don't have to stock things. We stock things that we feel are going to be good, reliable and suitable for the customer.
Yes, in different price ranges as well, but the same principles apply.
Yeah, and I suppose back in the days, back in the 20th century and into the 19th century, that would have occurred as well, that they would have stocked what they thought was best for the customers themselves.
And pardon my ignorance, would much of it have been made on site or...?
Jewellery-wise, jewellers can make the jewellery. Yeah. Watches and things like that.
No, of course not. They're specialists.
We can
repair them
and we can sell them and all that, but not actually manufacturing them. But with a good jeweller shop, we can work from building from the base upwards.
So talk us through, as much as you can, the generational shift in the business.
So back in the 1869 onwards, we've been Robert McCullough and probably his daughter working along with him. Then William Ball came in, worked along with them, and carrying on then into the newer generations, there would have been my dad and my uncle would have been running the business in 52 Main Street, which is where CT Ball is at the moment, or well, they've closed down now, but that's where the building was. In the 50s and 60s then, we would have bought the new premises down at 20 Main Street where we are at the moment. And I was mentioned before that I know exactly where my dad was on the day that I was born. He was in the solicitor's office signing the documentation on 20 Main Street.
Which is the current location.
The current location of it.
And there were two locations at that point, 20 Main Street as well. Did the brothers take a business each, so to speak, or did they mix
while
between the two?
While they were still in the 50s and 60s, they would have had the two together. So the Main Street would, the Upper Main Street at 52 would have been the jewellery, opticians, watches, things like that. The lower section then we did glass, china, giftware. So we did Waterford Crystal, Bleak China, things like that down below. Whenever my dad's family and my uncle's family were growing up, it was myself and my brother and then my cousins. So at that point in 1969, they decided to split it into two separate firms. We took the McCullough name down to 20 Main Street and Cecil Ball and his son Lance would have opened up under CT Ball in 1969.
Mm-hmm. And then there were two jewellery shops then that were established. Obviously, not two that were established, but a second was then as well.
Yes.
So the other brother transitioned back to jewellery?
We both then did, I suppose, similar ideas. So up in CT Ball, they did the jewellery and watches and some china, and Dad would have opened up with jewellery, watches and china down below as well.
Brilliant stuff. Okay. And at what point then, well, we know when you were born and we know what your dad was doing, right? But, were you always around the shop as a young lad?
I suppose, I remember being in and out of what we call the Upper Main Street over the years. Then obviously whenever my dad had his own shop down below, I would have been in and out all the time. With a family business, you're never away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Even today with Gareth, I will still be popping into the shop, seeing how things are. When my youngest guy was born in 2000, I picked him up from the hospital, Katrina, and picked up Katrina and Joshua then. We actually did a delivery to a place outside the town to drop off some jewellery on the way home from collecting him from the hospital, because he was born in December, which will be a busy time.
I'm sure you were happy with that. Was there any other opinions in the car?
No comment. We will go no further with that.
I'm not going to dig any deeper.
Joshua didn't say anything.
It sounds
anyway.
Like a fantastic anecdote from you. I'm just wondering, is there another version of this anecdote out there somewhere, you know?
Katrina knows that whenever Christmas is on, especially in the business, that December she doesn't see us.
Because it's very much, and I'm sorry to ignore you, Gareth, not my intention,
no, not at all.
But listen, we'll come to you in a moment. Now that I've got him on a roll, I'm going to keep going, right? Because it is incredibly a returning customer of the community, that personal service, that I'm just thinking, you know, if a man was coming in to buy one of the most important purchases he'll ever make, you know, an engagement, for example, and he doesn't want to consult the other half. There has to be a level of trust there, doesn't there, and understanding and working with him and his budget, but also giving him real advice as what's on trend, what might work for how a person might feel. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's very personal. It's one of those trades, isn't it?
It is. A lot of times we've had the parents being engaged with us and even the grandparents engaged with us. So we'd have three generations. And as regards kind of the different products and the different prices, Gareth, you're probably good at this because with the new process of diamonds and lab-grown diamonds, you can adjust it to suit the price points.
But you can still have the same...
So
wow.
Going back to the way you were asking how old jewellers are run, we are probably run fairly similar, just with more modern techniques. The values and the quality aspect still dates back to 1869. So from that, we obviously keep up with current trends, but if a customer wants something made that isn't going to last them, we let them know that and we'll guide them towards something that is actually going to last them, that they can still have, you know, the on-trend ring, but just tweaking it slightly so that it is going to last them.
Yeah, but you really have to have confidence in your business and your business model there, because for some you could be turning trade away, but you have to be honest with the customer, don't you? You have to say, this is the reality, because the raw materials you are working with are inherently expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking gold, we're talking diamonds, we're talking, you know, the source materials come at a premium.
We've had to make difficult decisions in the past. We had a range of rings in, and after seeing a few of them, we just felt that the quality wasn't there, and we actually had to pull the whole range and replace it with something different.
Yeah.
And it was a difficult decision because the price point we were selling was going from 500 to 800. We were now jumping that up to 1,200, 1,300 up. So it was a huge market that we were possibly alienating. But at the end of the day, it's the quality, and the customer has to be getting something that's going to last. You know, you want it to last a full marriage. You don't want it to, you know.
No, of course not.
Break a few years.
And maybe it is the same with jewellery. It seems very simple for us in terms of cars, right? Expensive car, good. Cheap car will get you where you need to be, but in terms of its resale value and longevity, we understand that. I wonder, does the customer understand that it's the same with many products, including jewellery? But that's your job to explain that.
I think that's clearly where we come in. We can kind of explain that to them and help them guide them through that process.
Okay, we are in conversation with the latest inductee to the Letterkenny Chamber Hall of Fame, Julian Ball of R. McCullough Jewellers. Also have his son Gareth. We're going to come back after the break and we're going to talk about Julian's education and I suppose getting into the business in earnest. That's just in a couple of moments. We're in conversation with Julian Ball of R. McCullough Jewellers and his son Gareth. Julian is the latest inductee into Letterkenny Chambers Hall of Fame, and I'm just curious as to your sort of transition into the business, because I suppose it feels a little bit like me to some extent. In the mid-teens, you left school, decided to go into watchmaking. Did that cause any issues? Was that what was expected of you? Did it just seem like the obvious decision?
I suppose it's kind of not expected of you, but there's an option there for it. My dad did take me out from school. I was in school in Sligo at the time. Whenever we drive in the car and I was sitting in the back, mum and dad in the front, and he turned around and he says, what do you want to be in life? Do you want to be a watchmaker or an optician? And I thought, yeah, I like the mechanical aspect of things, that small parts, working with it. I have small hands, so they're very, very, very suitable for the job. And I thought, yeah, that'll be a nice job to go with. So at that point, I became a watchmaker and then obviously learned the rest of the trade as we went along.
And is it sort of seen as an essential part of it, to have the watchmaking expertise, or it just the way your sort of dad influenced you? Because I think your brother also, Colin, became a watchmaker as well. Yeah,
yeah. It's not. There's a lot of jewelers, places sell jewelry around the country don't have all the qualifications. It's always, to do a proper job, do a full job as a jeweller shop, you need the experience behind it.
Yes.
So whether it is watchmaking, whether it's jewellery repairs, jewellery manufacturing, or the associated trades like diamond graders, valuers, things like that, the more experience you have within the company, the better the company can be run.
So when then did you sort of take up your position in the business, right? Was that at 18?
At 18...
Or did you study and you were hands-on in the shop at the same time as well?
Well, once you learn in the college in Dublin, the Irish Swiss Institute of Horology, whenever you leave that, you are a fully trained watchmaker.
Yes.
You then have to learn how to get your point across to the customer. So whenever the watch, whatever work it needs done, you have to get across them. So you learn that on the floor, listening to my dad, listen to how he taught, how he kind of treated his customers, and I picked all that up. And I hope that my boys have picked the same thing as well on the next generation then.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know if people ever thought that sort of, you know, analog watches or however it might be described might become a thing of the past. Obviously, there's a plethora of smart watches and people use those and for keep fitness and what have you. But the I think the impressive look of the type of watches that you sell and work on, and of course there's hybrid watches as well, by the way. I'm not saying that these technologies can't be amalgamated, but it maintains the class of a watch. A good watch is always there. It's often a sign. It's something people will comment on, right? It's your shoes and your watch and something else. It's going to persist, isn't it? It's not going to become a thing of the past, I don't think.
I don't think so. There's always been trends back in the 70s, then the digital watch came out. Yeah. People thought no one's going to buy a watch with hands anymore.
How badly did people need a calculator to have a fully fledged, full calculator button on the wrist?
Yeah. Did you have anything small enough to actually depress the buttons and work it all out?
No, but like, who thought, right, everyone's going to need a calculator on the wrist eventually? But anyway, that was another trend. Yeah. And then I do remember for the younger ones, there was very basic games on them, but fundamentally it comes back to watches for telling time.
They moved then obviously to the likes of battery watches, and technology has moved on through now that we're with some of our brands, they only do mechanical watches again. They're back to what's called the automatic. So they're moving the arm, winds it, so you don't put batteries in it. As long as you wear it for a reasonable period every so often, it keeps the watch working.
And where are you at now in terms of your day-to-day involvement? Because I'm going to bring Gareth in a second. You've been on it for 42 years now, right?
Yeah, in theory, I'm retired.
But you're like a tailor. My dad was a bespoke tailor, right? You never retire.
No.
Whilst you can still go in, you don't. You're still going to go in. And you're still going to be involved.
I'm in the background if Gareth or Joshua...
Is it the background, Gareth?
For the most part, yeah.
Or foreground.
I'm learning to to keep quiet.
Gareth, so how similar is your story to that of your dad's? Did you complete your second the secondary school, or?
Yeah, no, I completed secondary school. I actually went to college then and I studied law. Mm. It was only when I finished my law degree that I thought I really don't like...
It's like the mafia, you're in it, though. You try and get away, but they pull you back in.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I decided then that my passion lay more in diamonds as opposed to watches or, you know, the jewellery end of it. And I went to London for the over and back for the better part of 4 or 5 years and did my training. So I'm a fully qualified diamond grader. I've trained under GMA and GIA in London as well.
And the amount of studying you have to do to be fully qualified in your area is remarkable.
It's the final exam, we were given 6 stones. We're in a very small, dark room. You're given 6 clear stones. You have to identify correctly if each of the 6 stones are diamond or not. If they're a diamond, you have to fully grade them. You have to get 95% to pass.
You are one of a very small group of fully qualified people in this area, in this country, that is active.
I would say I know of about 6 or 7 in the whole country.
And also, too, you learned during your studies that you were colourblind.
Yes. 2 days before one of my final exams.
Is it a grade of coloured blindness? It must be.
Purple, yellow, grey, so I have difficulty with shades.
Yes.
Shades of grey specifically, I can't really see. So to me, it literally is black or white. I can't really see the in-between times. But it was 2 days before an exam.
So that means you faced a complete barrier, but an additional challenge to achieving the score required to qualify?
Not a complete barrier by any means. I sort of have to work backwards. So most people would start with the colour of a stone and work through it. I would work backwards, so I would do all of the technical testing and it would lead me to a result that it has to be one of these two colours. And because I can see most colours, but I just can't see the shades within it. And for a lot of that, it doesn't really affect what I do and how I do it. I've adapted over the years. This was maybe 10, 12 years ago.
Considering how clearly we can trace the history back and the passing of this business through the generations, it must be a great feeling to be part of that.
Absolutely.
Because dynasties, I don't know what we describe it, dynasties or whatever you might call it, that always has connotations, right? Mm-hmm. But just sort of something that multi-generational businesses that can be traced back continuously to a certain time. It's quite a remarkable thing to be a part of, and clearly doing something that you love because you tried law and you were drawn back to the diamond side of it.
I always enjoyed being in the shop, whenever I was small, being in the shop as well. And when I went to secondary school in St. Junan's, I would still come down, you know, especially around this time of year, I would come down for my lunch and served.
It's a night time for scheming when your dad has your shop on the main street, isn't it? I wouldn't know anything about that personally either. But Julian, you're in a great position as well, that you've done your time. Look, you're not out of it. We know that. We've established that, right? But it's wonderful that you can see your business in safe hands and the bloodline continues.
Exactly, yeah.
It's very encouraging for you, isn't it? It's almost like your work is done, but I'm going to still work.
Yeah, and hopefully for generations to come.
Yeah, indeed. Well, listen, busy time of the year, isn't it? This time of the year. I'd say you can recognise the different people as they walk through the door, can you? That nervous fella that's never been in before.
We're pretty good at spotting engagement
couples. Pockets deeper than their arms and those that are minted. And you, over the years, I'd say you can pick out the... I know which one I am. I'm the one that doesn't know what I'm doing. All right, okay.
We've great staff, though, that can guide people through.
You know, no, of course, but of course you have to too. And it's a balance too, to let someone have a little look and then know when to go over and say, can I assist
when
you?
People want help.
You have mastered that at this stage.
And if someone wants to come in for a Christmas decoration, they'd be treated exactly the same they would be if they're coming for a diamond ring.
Yeah, I have no doubt about that. Gareth, anything you want to say about your dad?
No, it's the award is well-deserved from... revolutionising by putting in a computer back in 1998. Up until that, we were handwritten. He's constantly progressed the shop forward. He's never, you know, sat still. And he's allowed me to progress it as well. Back, I suppose, before I was in charge by any means, I would have been allowed to do certain things that he probably knew were going to fail. But I think I needed that to... you know, to learn.
It's a line, guidance, interference, and other things as well. You have to know.
If you don't fail, you never learn.
100%. Yeah. Well, is it going from strength to strength? It's great that Julian obviously still has his involvement, but it's clear that the business is continuing into the next generation in safe hands, and as Julian says, hopefully for many years to come. And also, you're nice, young, and healthy to be able to enjoy your Hall of Fame award. You know what I mean? It's not posthumous or anything.
No.
You can walk around with pride up and down Letterkenny Main Street. Brilliant stuff. Julian Ball, thank you so very much. Gareth, thank you for calling up as well. Both of you really enjoyed speaking to you. That is Julian Ball of R. McCullough Jewellers in Letterkenny, who is this year's recipient or entry, I suppose, into the Letterkenny Chamber Hall of Fame, and joins some incredibly important names in the history of business in Letterkenny and surrounds. And Gareth as well, thank you for coming up, for your insight, and dare I say perhaps a little bit of moral support.